meetings where we're going to be talking about the projects on the Tier 1 corridors. So last month, we were in Washington County and heard from some of the local improvement teams. But today we're actually going to be hearing from our technical team to talk about a technical review of projects from the Kittleson staff. So that's going to help us understand both what the LIT teams reviewed and what projects mean and look like on the ground. So a lot of good information tonight.
And good evening. I want to also thank you for coming out to Washington County last month. It was great to be able to host out there. Again, special thanks to Mayor Doyle for hosting. I know you did. But it was good, as JVP just mentioned, to listen to the local investment teams and to have the opportunity to host right on our transit line right there. So thank you for that. Before we move into public comment, I just want to remind you that we have changed the format. The last format change was at last month's meeting. We are taking the first 15... It's 15, isn't it?
Yes, but not the first. It's a lot.
It's a lot. I'm sorry. You sign up as soon as you come in at 5:30. We will, if we are over 15, we will go into a lottery draw. If not, we will be providing everybody with the opportunity. We really want to make sure that we respect the volunteer time of our task force and at the same time get the input from the public that we need to get. But that said, I want to remind all of you again how important it is to provide written testimony. The written testimony is something that stays with us, and we have it, we read it. It's very important. Even if you're giving oral testimony, I highly encourage you to provide us with written testimony as well. So thank you for your patience in changing our format, but we do feel that this will be a productive move going forward. So with that, Allison, we have a couple housekeeping issues first.
Yes. So we're back at Metro this evening. Our emergency exit will be down the stairs, and in the unlikely event of an emergency, we'll meet in the plaza directly behind us. Restrooms are down the hall and to your left. There's also a water fountain out there, and there should be water outside. And I hope everybody got an opportunity to get some dinner this evening. So I think those are all of our big housekeeping items, and we'll move into public comment. Okay, so we have two requests for public comment this evening from Ron and Bradley. You'll get a minute and 45 seconds each, and I'd invite you to come sit next to me up here at the table. So, Ron, first up.
Ron Swarn, Portland, Oregon. There's a couple things I want to talk about regarding natural events that kind of influence a lot of the discussion on transportation. One is the earthquake danger. I worked as a union carpenter beginning in the 80s and 90s when seismic upgrading was kind of coming on. And this recently obtained this report, OSU and USGS. And the samples they did for the Cascadian subduction zone were on the continental shelf line. So that's about 110 to 120 miles west of here. So I don't think we have a real high risk in this area. I know there's been a lot of spending so far addressing that and a lot of proposed spending, but I think the risk is somewhat low, and they say it's greater in north and south. The other thing, I know I-5 is one of the subjects, and I've been interested in that for quite a while because while working, I saw how the commuting patterns were changing in this area. Washington County was producing a lot of jobs. Clark County had a lot of people moving in. So, and we saw even back then people were coming long distances. So a new commuting paradigm had developed. And I was involved in the last several years in addressing the Columbia River crossing issue. And I thought there were ways that we could address that better. And one way would be with a west side route. I wasn't thinking of an interstate system freeway, but in Washington County, there's a proposal called the Northern Connector that's discussed in this executive summary. And this is something that could be done at a very low cost and would forestall a lot of the expenses that we're considering. So, okay. Anyway, thank you.
Howdy. My name is Bradley Bondi. I'm a resident of Clackamas County, and over the summer I served on the Clackamas County Lit. So in 2016, Seattle and LA passed some really big and bold measures to drastically expand transit and bike head infrastructure throughout their regions. And going into the Lit process, I was really hoping to see a similarly bold vision in the projects that we looked at. Unfortunately, that's not what was presented. What was proposed for Clackamas County was more of the same. It primarily focused on subsidizing suburban sprawl while advancing some minor improvements on our two urban corridors, 82nd and McLaughlin. All in all, about two-thirds of the revenue proposed to be spent in Clackamas County would be directed towards Happy Valley, enabling sprawl onto our farm and forest land. Quite frankly, the projects that were presented to us do not align with the values of this task force. They fail to advance equity, they fail to meaningfully reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and they fail to meaningfully address the massive safety challenges that exist on 82nd and McLaughlin. So, real briefly, I'm running out of time here. I got three real suggestions. I ask that this task force pursue a more bold set of projects along McLaughlin and 82nd, light rail on McLaughlin, bus rapid transit on 82nd. This is very likely to be the one opportunity that we have this decade to get any significant funding for these two corridors. All right, thanks.
Okay, and don't forget you can always submit written testimony that will be shared with all of the advisory committee members, and we appreciate everybody coming in to give us their testimony today and their comments today. So throughout this process, we've had a lot of requests from advisory committee members to hear from TriMet and get a better understanding from them about their strategic plan, about their approaches for increasing transit ridership, and to dig into the further questions people have just about transit service in general. And in light of that, TriMet and Metro staff arrange a workshop on September 25th for task force members to be able to hear from TriMet, to get their questions asked. And it was a really successful meeting. It ended up running for an hour and 45 minutes. So while we wouldn't have time to duplicate that today, we did want to give the entire committee a chance to hear from TriMet and to have a summary of what was talked about, a recap of what was talked about at that meeting. And to that end, we have Bernie Bottomley from TriMet, who is the director of their public affairs, with us tonight to help give us the recap and answer some questions.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. So I'm just going to take a few minutes to recap the presentation that we gave. There's material in the packet, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if you would like additional detail, let me know and we'll get that out to you. So we covered basically four topics with the committee on our presentation. We talked about transit equity and inclusion and fair initiatives. We talked about the transit service update and future service outlook. So what are our plans for additional service across the region going out the next 5 years? We talked about enhanced transit and better bus, which are two strategies that we are pursuing along with the cities. And you've seen in the proposals for the ballot measure support for those initiatives as well. And then some of the regionally significant transit projects, the really big projects, such as Southwest Corridor and studying a tunnel through downtown and how those are shaping our thinking for the long-term future. So just very quickly on each of those topics, we touched on transit equity and inclusion. I'm not going to focus on our board and our leadership staff and so forth, but we are making tremendous strides in that arena and bringing more diversity to our leadership core and using our Transit Equity Advisory Committee, TAC, and our Committee on Accessible Transportation to get input on all kinds of policies that the agency is contemplating from various sectors of the community. But the one I wanted to focus on here is the transit access and low-income fare programs. TriMet has had a transit access program where we essentially subsidize fares for programs that serve low-income and vulnerable populations for a number of years. We've partnered with about 35 community-based organizations to funnel those passes out to people in the community who are in great need, and it's been a tremendous partnership because those community-based organizations have a very good sense of who in the community really could benefit from the access to the transit system, and that relieves us of the burden of trying to figure out who should receive the benefit. More recently, with the passage of House Bill 2017, we committed to setting up a low-income fare program. The impetus for that was to offset some of the impact of the tax from House Bill 2017 on low-income populations. It's available to any individual who is at 200% of the federal poverty level or below. And to date, we have about 20,000 individuals who've qualified for that program. And we use the same model for that program as we use for the transit access program, which is partnering with community-based organizations and having them essentially do the qualification process and distributing the passes to their clientele, which relieves us of that administrative burden and make sure that it's targeted at those folks who really need the help of the program. That 20,000 is about a 50% higher number than we thought we'd be at this point in rolling out the program. It's been very, very positive. And in addition, we have a program that provides student passes for students who qualify for free and reduced lunch. That's a $700,000 a year program. $500,000 of that comes from House Bill 2017. $200,000 comes from TriMet. And that's distributed by the school districts. And then after that, we have a program with Portland Public Schools where TriMet subsidizes an additional $1 million worth of passes for Portland Public Schools each year. On the transit service side, some of you may know that TriMet is implementing an increase in the employer payroll tax. So that's separate from House Bill 2017. That's a tax that the employers pay at 1/100% per year over 10 years. And that started in 2016 and will continue to ramp up until 2026. So we'll be getting an increase in our revenues in addition to the natural growth of the payroll tax over the next 6 or 7 years. And we'll be using those funds to ramp in additional service. That's an important process for us because it's difficult given the time frame it takes. Sorry. Can everybody hear me now? Nope? A little more? How's that? I don't really have a voice that carries. So we ramp in the service over a period of time. That gives us the ability to bring on additional buses, which take a couple of years to bring on site. We're now at the point where we have to build a fourth operating facility because our three existing facilities have outgrown their footprint. We don't have room to park buses anymore. So ramping in that service over time is really the most efficient way for us to do it. In addition to that, we have the funding from House Bill 2017, and although we get all of that resource essentially in 1 year, it takes us a couple of years to actually absorb those new funds and get them out on the street in service hours because it takes a couple of years to get buses, it takes a couple of years to train mechanics, it takes at least a year. Hello. It takes about a year to recruit and train drivers and so forth. So those increases are going to happen over the next 4 or 5 years. So we'll see growth, assuming there's no big recession, for the next 4 or 5 years. What that looks like is on this page, both in terms of where it's geographically distributed and then in the kinds of additional service that we are putting out on the street. New bus lines, additional service on weekends, additional service on evenings and early in the morning, increasing the frequency on existing routes, adding two more 20. We have one line that runs 24 hours a day, adding more lines that run 24 hours a day, and then increasing a couple of lines, five additional lines, to that 15-minute service level, which is our frequent service, kind of our premium service level. So even though there's not a proposal in the measure to increase operating resources for TriMet, we are going to be rolling out substantial additional service over the next 5 years because of the payroll tax resources that are coming in. What we are proposing, and you see in the proposals that are being discussed, are a couple of capital investments that will help support the agency's mission. The Enhanced Transit and Better Bus Program is one of those. This is the bus system moves two-thirds of the passengers in the TriMet system every day. Light rail does a tremendous job, but kind of the day-to-day workhorse is the bus system. And over time, buses traveling on the same streets as the rest of the car traffic get slowed down by congestion. And that means we have to put more buses out just to maintain our frequency. So if we are trying to have a bus come every 15 minutes and congestion makes the system slower, we have to put additional buses out to maintain that 15 minutes. We're not carrying any additional passengers with that bus. We're just allowing people to wait in the bus instead of waiting at the bus stop, right? It's not a very efficient allocation of our resources. By doing things like queue jump lanes, red paint, signal preemption, stop placement, and a number of these other strategies that we bundle in this idea called enhanced transit, we can make the existing hours of service that are out on the system more efficient. We can get more out of the money we're already spending on hours of service. So we think it's a tremendous, it holds tremendous promise for the entire system. And then those bigger projects that you may all be familiar with, the Southwest Corridor project, of course, our expectation is when that's built and in operation, it will carry on the order of 40,000 trips a day. That's on par with what the Blue Line does, you know, the original east-west line, which gives you a sense of how much demand there is in that corridor and how difficult that corridor is to serve with road expansion. It's a very tight quarters there in the Twilliger curves, as everyone knows. And then thinking about the long term, looking at a potential for a tunnel under downtown Portland, so that we can really maximize the throughput from east to west, and then converting the surface system to something like a streetcar so we still have the circulation in downtown. And then our strategy of converting from a diesel bus fleet to a non-diesel fleet, primarily our goal right now is through converting to battery electric buses. In the long term, that holds the promise of reducing our costs because the fuel, the electricity, is less expensive than diesel, and the buses themselves are easier to maintain than the diesel buses are. So we hope to realize some significant operational savings once those fleets are in place, but there's a significant capital investment up front in order to get there. And we've suggested that one potential for the measure is to help offset that capital, initial capital investment. So just to recap, we have significant expansion plans and funding to accomplish those plans over the next 5 years with additional resources actually coming through to 2026. the capital investments that are embedded in the proposals that you all have been looking at really have a tremendous carry-on effect benefit to the transit agency by making us more efficient and reducing our carbon footprint. And then, you know, in the longer term, of course, I would never want to be accused of being a public agency official and then not looking for money over the long term, because, of course, we always do and will, and as things like Cap and Invest come down the pike and things like tolling, where we need to put in parallel facilities to have a mitigation for the toll, those are obviously places where we would look for additional resources for operating. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. Okay, great.
So we do have time for questions. Before we, and I'm happy to, well, I'll let Elton people take that, but I did want to mention that the slides that Bernie used in the meeting in September, as well as the audio of that meeting, is available online if anybody's interested in really getting into a deep dive and hearing how that meeting went.
Okay, thanks. I have three questions, and I'll put it in the form of one question so I don't take a lot of time. So could you address three things a little bit more? One, just in thinking of our early values, talk a little bit about the transition off diesel buses and onto battery electric buses and alternative fuels and what kind of climate benefit you're going to get out of that, too. The student passes, is that just Portland Public or... does it go also to my two favorite school districts, Park Rose and Beaverton? I went to Park Rose. The kids have in Beaverton. Just in terms of one of the things, when you guys did your own payroll tax adjustment, we had a group that met with you where you talked a lot about how you're changing routes between employment centers, not necessarily through the hub and spokes model downtown,
right?
Getting people to work and sort of making that easier for people who don't have cars, etc. So could you talk about those three things, students,
sure,
climate, and employment?
Yeah. So on the battery electric bus strategy, we time it by virtue of taking people off the roads. We reduced carbon emissions in the region. We do it actually in a couple of different ways. One is by taking people out of their cars. There's a net reduction in carbon emissions. The other is through the combination of transit, particularly light rail, and the regional land use plans, we build centers. And we help maintain the urban growth boundary and allow for greater density. Centers are those concentrated areas of development and activity, whether it's residential density or commercial and office density, where we have, you know, 3 and 4 and 5 and up to 20 stories, instead of spreading that activity out over a lot of acres that consume developable land and push us to move the urban growth boundary farther out. When the region was tasked by the legislature with coming up with a carbon reduction strategy and analyzed what tools might be available to accomplish that carbon reduction, the most important tool in the toolbox is the urban growth boundary and our 2040 plan for how we develop within that urban growth boundary. I don't know if any of you read Dr. No in last week's Planet Week, but there was a question. No one? Yeah, Mark Zussman is going to be really unhappy. There was a question about, well, gosh, buildings are really big carbon emitters, and, you know, what's our strategy for getting rid of these, you know, big office towers? And, of course, the answer was, actually, you want more office towers because they're per capita, per unit of output, they're the lowest carbon emitters compared to having, you know, offices spread out in the fringes of their growth boundary where you have to drive and park and so forth. So to get back to battery electric bus, we have a net reduction in carbon by running the transit system, but we are, at the same time, we're the biggest consumer of single consumer of diesel in the state in order to run those buses. And our goal is to zero that out by 2040 or before. by implementing a battery electric bus strategy. And we have five buses on property today running out in Denny Doyle's neighborhood. And we have five more that we're going to order here shortly. But we have a 700-bus fleet. And so converting that whole fleet is a huge undertaking and, you know, is about the difference between buying 700 battery electric buses and 700 diesel buses, about $500 million difference. So one of the reasons that you see a proposal in the measure to support a battery electric bus version is to help us with that conversion cost. On the student fare program, how much time do you have? We have a policy at TriMet that any school district that wants to offer a universal pass to all of their students, TriMet will pick up one-third of the cost of that if the school district and the school district's partners pick up the other two-thirds. The only school district that currently participates in that program is Portland. And the reason Portland participates is they're the only district in the state that has an exemption from the state law that requires that they provide yellow bus service. Every other district must provide yellow bus service by law. And the reason that Portland got that exemption is because of the existence of TriMet. They got that exemption, but there was no legislative activity to help pay the transit costs for students in the TriMet district who now have to pay for a transit pass versus the students in the other districts who get free yellow bus service. So there was an inequity that was created by that legislation. And the solution to that has changed over time. At periods of time, there's been a Betsy credit that has paid for it and so forth, but all those things went away. And right now, the way it works is Portland Public Schools pays two-thirds of the subsidized cost. We pay one-third, in addition to the 50% discount that we provide youth. That program got extended to David Douglas and Park Rose for 2 years using some funding that the city of Portland had. That funding has run out, will run out at the end of this school year. So the program that's available for the districts who don't have resources to do the two-thirds, one-third program is the House Bill 2017 program, which has 1% of the House Bill 2017 funding must be used for a student pass program. That's about $500,000 a year, and TriMet is augmenting that with an additional $200,000 of its general fund resource. That's a different program. That's targeted at students who qualify for free and reduced lunch. The Portland Public School program is available to every student, whether they have a parent who's, you know, lives in the West Hills and makes millions of dollars or not. But where there's a limited resource, our advisory committee on House Bill 2017 and our board felt that we should target that at students that are low income. So it provides passes and other resources. Some schools want both passes for the school year and individual tickets because they have students who need a pass every day, and then they need students whose parents, you know, they got sick or whatever, their parents can't come pick them up. They want to give them a ticket so they can get home. So we allocate them based on the percentage of low-income students that they have in the district relative to the total. And then they get to decide how they want to use those passes. They want monthly passes or they want daily tickets. The third question was, all of the routes that you saw on the map that we have overlap essentially with the corridors that Metro has proposed as part of this measure. And so our investments in both time, bus hours, and in ETC are integrated, right? So they support each other.
Sorry I wasn't able to attend the optional workshop, but I did get the deck. Tyler actually sent it out, and so I was able to get through it. Hopefully everybody else was too. in, you mentioned here the five-year service plan, and I talked to somebody that was at the meeting, and I think I heard from them that that service plan has a 2% annual increase in ridership. Is that correct, or what is the plan?
Well, actually, it's a bigger increase in a percent than the service hours that increase over time are a little bit. And Jeff, I don't know if you know off the top of your head, it's about an additional $4 million a year in additional service every year for the next 5 years. And I don't know, on a percentage basis, it turns out to be around 20-ish, I think. When you get at the end of the 5 years, it's about a 20% increase in service hours.
Well, what about riders?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. We don't know exactly how many additional riders we're going to get. The plan, this plan, is a blend of ridership-driven investments and community service-driven investments. If we were only looking at ridership, that map would look a little different.
Mm-hmm.
It would look a lot more like the existing map. There wouldn't be many, if any, new routes. And those routes that are out on the edges of the urban area would go away because there's not a lot of ridership in those areas compared to the ridership you could get if you just put more buses on 82nd Avenue, for example. And that's because we have to balance those things. We have to balance the goal of increasing ridership with the need to make sure that all of the areas of the region are participating and have a level of service that, you know, is they have some service and it's not terrible service.
But just as a follow-up, I mean, I understand as a layperson the sort of general idea of service hours. It's just hard to understand that the agency doesn't think of the number of people actually boarding and riding, because how would you, like, know that you were getting cars off the road if you're not thinking about the number of people that get on the bus or the MAX?
We absolutely do think about that. And
but
we don't operate in a microcosm.
Yeah.
We don't have a region that sits still, for example. Mm. So if you know, 10 years ago you asked how many riders you're going to have, I could tell you for each hour of additional service we get X number of riders. That was before Lyft and Uber. That was before electric scooters and electric bikes. We're still, you know, figuring our way through that new world. So it's not a linear progression where I can tell you how many riders you're going to get for each additional increment of service hours.
Mm.
Now, my understanding is that Metro is going to model kind of the package in December-ish.
January.
Okay, let's not say December. Let's say January. So we should have a better answer to that question when the modeling is run. It'll be on a global basis. So what is the net impact of the package at that point? Does that help?
So trying to remember recent numbers, I'm remembering that mode share for bus ridership is either flat or declining, and that all of our climate plans, all the metro plans sort of call for mode share to be increasing somewhat dramatically, actually. So given the reality that we're in, and thinking about why people don't ride the bus, I'm going to make certain assumptions, like if they're stuck in traffic and it takes them longer to get there on the bus than in a car on an Uber or whatever, they're going to switch, assuming they can afford to do that. There's also the assumption that if you know, the same trip you can do in an Uber is going to take you 20 minutes because it's a direct route, as opposed to an hour and a half because you have to go to downtown Portland to get back to wherever it is you're going. What has TriMet thought about as solutions to getting us to the mode share that we all have in our plans to solve those variabilities around the speed of the buses, around routes that are more direct, more diffuse throughout the system?
Sure. Yeah, it's a great question. So is that okay? And I guess I would say that TriMet is not going to be able to do that itself. We can't put out enough hours to, you know, get to 40% mode share on transit without substantial investment in the roadways that we operate on and giving buses the opportunity to get out of that congestion and be competitive in travel time. And that's why we're so interested in the enhanced transit strategies, because that's what that is all about, is it's how do you allocate the right-of-way in such a manner that the transit vehicle has priority? Can they get through the traffic more quickly? And figuring out how to do that in a smart, site-specific, route-specific way, so we're not putting in queue jumps lanes, for example, where we don't need them. If we need signal priority in a place and that will solve the problem, great. If we need a queue jump lane, then yeah, okay, let's figure out how to do that. So the projects that the enhanced transit projects that we've done so far are proving out that we do get significant travel time savings. We're getting, 20 to 30% travel time savings for some of these changes. And the interesting thing about it is that our hope is that it's a fairly, I hate to say this when you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, but a fairly low cost approach. If you take the Division Transit Project, for example, we're putting in signal prioritization and queue jump lanes from downtown Portland out to Gresham. Most of the benefit of the changes actually occurs in the first few intersections as you're leaving downtown Portland, because that's where you've got the biggest ridership load and the most congestion. So we see this as a really interesting, innovative way to think about if you can really speed up those first few intersections, you get maybe 70% of the benefit of doing a whole line, and you're only doing two or three intersections.
So, we're going to take about three more minutes for questions. I only have one more question.
Well, I guess given the number of corridors that we're looking at and the kinds of projects we're looking at, are we going to make a significant change with what we're looking at?
I think we will. I think the modeling will help sort of answer that question. I think ultimately the question goes back to the local jurisdictions on these kinds of projects. Money is half the equation, maybe. The other half of the equation is the local jurisdiction who owns the road prepared to do what it takes to take a row of parking out or to take a lane out in order to put a queue jump lane in. That's going to be the real test.
All right, so we have about 2 more minutes.
So somewhat continuing on your line of discussion there about the effectiveness of things, the thing that I observe is there's a significant push on to build a connection on 205 that would connect all the way around to Oregon City from Stafford. Are we collaborating to see that we preserve an express bus lane, whether it's on the shoulder or not, to start that perimeter loop around the city that we've talked about, number one? Number two, I'm concerned and would like to hear your perspective about Southwest Corridor, which conceptually initially was going to go to Sherwood, then it was going to go to Tualatin, and then it was going to go to Bridgeport. Now they're talking about ending it in Tigard. Is it worth building if it only goes to Tigard? Are we really going to tap that market? I think we need to be cautious about truncating it to the point that it just doesn't really produce.
On the 205 question, we are, TriMet is working with ODOT right now to identify locations where we can pilot a bus on shoulder. So they do this over in Clark County, not quite on the same kinds of freeways that we have over here, but they run buses on the shoulder. And so we're looking to pilot that. That stretch of 205 is one of those places where it might make sense to do that. There are fewer interchanges and wider shoulders. And so we are in discussion with them about that. And then, of course, in the tolling conversation, the first policy recommendation was that there has to be a parallel transit service as a mitigation for the toll. And so if that moves forward, then there would need to be a very serious conversation about how does that function in that corridor. The second question was about
Southwest Corridor.
Our goal is to get to Bridgeport Village. You get a major benefit in terms of being able to divert travel off of I-5 if you get that far. It's always a challenge to build those projects because you're not just building a light rail project. You're rebuilding a major urban arterial basically from Portland to Bridgeport. And you're building bridges, you're building storm sewers, you're building bike paths, you're building pedestrian facilities that don't exist today. So it's not just a light rail project. And our goal is to get to Bridgeport. I don't want to take away from conversations that are yet to be had here, but I think we have a strategy to get there. We are going to do our darndest to get all the way to Bridgeport, and the general manager has sort of staked that out as his North Star for the project.
Thank you.
Bernie, thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation and the interaction. It's a valuable part of what we're here to do. We are going to hear from Kittleson tonight, and we're hoping to give as much time as we can to that piece and to allow for Q&A. So at this point, we're going to move the, quote, next steps up to now in the agenda. Andy's going to talk about the process where we will get a recommendation to Council about what projects we think should continue to be developed on the Tier 1 corridors and our work through the rest of the year, what all that will look like. Also, in your packets, you have a memo that was prepared by staff that outlines the dates and the content of our upcoming meetings between now and May of 2020. So take a look at that. Make sure that that gets from that packet to your calendars, please, and also understand what the process is going to be. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Andy.
Well, so the first thing I was going to say is please do look at the memo from Tyler in the packet. It does a good job of walking through all the dates to come, and it's a little daunting. So again, thank you all for your service on this task force. Just a couple highlights, though. Again, tonight we're asking Kittleson to walk through. Let me actually back up one meeting. Your last meeting, we had people selected by the LIT teams to come talk to you about their process and what they learned and their evaluation of projects and corridors. Tonight we're trying to go a deeper level, talking about how do we look at these projects? What are the variations of projects? What are some of the places around the region? We decided not to go through every single project in detail because we don't have enough time for that. But we're trying to pull out thematics that you can then use to look at a variety of projects where there's a corridor that's largely a safety focus, or a corridor that's largely a transit focus, or a corridor that's largely about mobility for automobiles. So hopefully that will be very instructive, and I hope you have some questions and answers tonight. on Friday. We're still working on it. We'll be at the co-chairs tomorrow to move it forward. On Friday, we'll be sending you staff recommendations for how what we would suggest you begin your conversation with on the 30th around the projects and the corridors. We've done a lot of work with our local jurisdictional partners. We look deeply at the evaluation we got from the LITs. Looked at your outcomes and your values that you laid out and the direction you got from our council. And we'll be finishing that up this week to get out to you as a way to start your conversation around what do we think lines up with the values, with what we've heard from the LITs, and also looking at readiness, cost, availability of funds from local governments, and the ability to put these projects in the ground. So it's a blending of all those things that will come into the recommendation. We'll send you a survey next week as another instrument to try to get some sort of a prioritization process going and hopefully set you up for a discussion about trade-offs at the meeting on the 30th between the recommendation and the survey instrument that you use. And then we'll take a little break since we have two meetings in October, only one meeting in November, and we're hoping to have robust dialogue on the 30th, more dialogue on the 20th of November, and come to a recommendation or feedback to the Metro Council. And we'll take all of your input and your dialogue to the Metro Council in December and work with them to get direction on projects. It's important for us to try to nail down as soon as we can direction on the projects and the corridors that we want to move forward, because there's a further process of work to really, as tightly as we can, nail down the costs, the risks on these projects, so we can then model what benefits, what results do we get as a result of this suite of projects. I will also note, is it on this? So that's what's coming up ahead. Again, look at the memo. Next week, I would note, and we've got postcards out on the table if you want to take some and hand them out to your friends. Three events, one in each county, that's intended to be a chance for the public to come in and get exposed to some of the work that you've been doing, the corridors, the nature of the kinds of projects that we're looking at, the kinds of high-level values outcomes that we're trying to advance the transportation measure. So it's a chance for the public to begin engaging in this process, not at the depth and not the level that you have been engaging, but we're hoping to use this as a way to get more feedback at a high level, build some excitement in each of the counties around the work that you're doing. So just a note, I hope that you can attend those, and please encourage others to attend. Whoa. I think I hit the wrong button. No, I hit the wrong button. Just kidding. The last 2 points here. So we advanced 13 corridors earlier in the year, and we brought 11 of those corridors forward to the local investment teams for work over the summertime. We told you Southwest Corridor was a project that had robust engagement along the corridor with a steering committee and also a Southwest Corridor Equitable Development group. So we weren't using the LIT process to evaluate that, but we heard a little bit tonight about that project. To reinforce what Bernie noted, it's a long process to get to where it is, but it's much more than just two rail lines going down to Walton. There are road projects, bridge projects, sewer, water projects, park projects, trails, et cetera, all along that corridor. We'll bring you more information on that as the recommendations come out. Albina, the Albina area was another sort of corridor or area that we set aside because there was a different dialogue going on there. There has been some very good work between PBOT and the Albina Vision Group to propose a set of projects there. And so we'll bring those forward for discussion and review in this same process. That's why I make that note so that doesn't surprise you. But that was not through the LIT process that we used. Is there one more slide? No. The last note I think I was supposed to make is Tier 2 corridors. What happened to them? So we have asked local jurisdictions who want to advance a Tier 2 corridor to do a series of things, do some work to show us cost, how much work has been done, what kind of planning work has been done on a corridor, what kind of engagement has been done or will be done in the future. Are there partners, ODOT, TriMet, others, who would need to be involved in the development or construction of a project, and are they on board with advancing that project for further work and examination? Those are due this month, and to the extent we have corridors that come forward in that tier two process, we'll bring those to you in 2020, in the new year, for evaluation after we've gone through this process, after we've looked at revenues, what money we have, we'll then bring you additional information on those. just as a highlight, we're not hearing from jurisdictions. An immense number of project of those Tier 2 projects coming forward, five or six or so, is what we're hearing, that there's interest in advancing from local jurisdictions.
So thank you, Andy, for that view of our timeline and the work that we're going to be doing in the short term and in the long term in the next few months. So at the last meeting, at the end of the meeting, if you remember, we asked you to give us some information about what types of projects, on the corridors, what types of projects on the corridors you wanted to learn more about, and what corridors in general you had the most questions about, what you didn't know enough about. And so, because we want to make sure as much as possible that you have an understanding of what projects the LIT members reviewed and how their feedback on those projects, how their feedback on the values that they have for those projects, how our feedback on our values shape the staff recommendations that are coming out on Friday, which we're going to use to shape the conversation that we're going to have on October 30th for our task force recommendation. And so what the feedback was is that you want to know what is considered a safety project, what is considered a transit project, how to think about what types of projects reduce greenhouse gas emissions, what it means to actually plan for future growth, and then you had specific corridors that you did have questions about. So Camilla from Kittleson, hello Camilla, welcome. She actually holds the records for attending the most local improvement team meetings this summer, as well as leading those meetings. She's here today to give us a really good discussion on how that process went and to get more into the projects on the corridors. We have a whole hour for this on the corridor, so we do want to delve into details, but there are 13 corridors, so we don't have as much time as maybe some of us would like to go through it. But she's going to give us some information to equip us on having better knowledge about these projects that is going to help us with the decisions and the discussions that we're going to have at our upcoming and future meetings. So with that, take it away.
Great. Thank you so much. So, like I said, we don't have enough time to go through each project in detail. So we're going to talk a lot about the corridor outcomes, and then we're going to talk about how specific projects help us meet those outcomes. And what you'll see when you get the full list, when you're looking at the full list of projects, is that there are a lot of themes that come up within the project. So we will discuss things like how to think about how we've been thinking about these safety corridors and how we've been developing the safety project. So you know that when you're looking at all of the projects along all of the corridors, when you see these safety projects come up, then how these were developed. So first, we'll talk a little bit about where each of these projects came from, where did they originate, and then we'll talk about some of those outcomes of safety, transit, supporting regional growth, advancing racial equity, addressing climate change, and we'll have a little bit of time for discussion at the end. Can I just get a quick thumbs up from the back of the room if you can hear me okay? Great. Thank you. So thinking about where these projects originated. So first we looked at the regional transportation plan. The reason why we went to this first is because we know that these projects in the RCP are rooted in a strong community development. And actually there were 19,000 comments from community members that helped inform the RTP. So that's where we started. But then we went to the local agencies and asked if they had any projects on these corridors that helped us meet the intended outcomes. We then took kind of a step back and looked holistically at each of the corridors and looked for whether or not there were any missing pieces. So if we had a project on one section of the corridor and another, that there was nothing connecting them and that connection was needed, then we developed projects to fill that gap. And we took each of these projects to the local investment teams, to the LITs this summer, to get their feedback. And we actually added some projects because of LIT feedback to our project list. And finally, we got about 3,500 responses to this spring, summer online survey that was specifically put out for this regional planning measure. So that was also kind of wrapped into the group as we were coming up with these projects. Now jumping straight into the outcomes and safety. And I know that safety is a really important one, and it's one that you'll see coming up on most of these corridors are going to be major safety projects. So when we're thinking about a safety project, the goal for that safety project really is to reduce the severity and the frequency of crashes along the corridor. And we do have a special focus on vulnerable users like bicyclists and pedestrians because they don't have kind of that protective armor that other modes do have. We'll talk a little bit about that in a second, too. And specifically, many of our Tier 1 corridors do show up as high crash corridors in the region. And so when we're thinking about all of these corridors from McLaughlin to TE to 185th on the west side, all the way over to the east side, 162nd, 82nd, then some of these key elements of of safety projects do occur on all of these different corridors. So how do we improve safety? We give people who are biking and people who are walking more safer places to do those activities, and we give drivers more time to respond. Also, when we're thinking about coming up with safety projects, we make sure that we don't just come up with a spot treatment here because there have been a lot of crashes specifically in this location. We do look at past crash data, but we also make sure that we're thinking about it systemically so that there's continuity along an entire corridor. Some elements that you might find of some of the high crash corridors that I just mentioned are things like long distances between pedestrian crossings or enhanced crossings, unprotected or crossings that are not enhanced, no street lighting, and fast traffic. And these are some of the elements that we see kind of commonalities along each of the corridors. And I want to, some of these elements that we want to add to some of the high crash corridors to make sure that we are improving the safety is going to be adding those enhanced crossings, adding lighting, adding centered medians in places that it makes sense, adding protected or buffered bicycle lanes and sidewalks, and some other things like higher visibility crosswalks. And 82nd Avenue is one of the corridors that is a high crash corridor and for which we have a safety project. And just to give you a little bit of context, because I mentioned a lot of different high crash corridors, and each of those have a little bit different context. And so when we're approaching each of these, then we design them a little bit differently depending on the land use context. And so thinking about 82nd Avenue, then it's pretty established. You have a lot of development along the corridor and a lot of different uses. And that means that there are a lot of driveways and there are a lot of intersections on 82nd Avenue, a lot of access points into different businesses. And so it's not uncommon for many of the crashes on 82nd Avenue and similar roads to be related to these driveways or these intersections where people either slowing down or stopping or turning. And just to, I'm sure that we've all been in a similar situation where when you're at a signal and you're trying to turn left and there's a lot of oncoming traffic and you don't have a protected left face, so you don't know when you're going to be able to make that left turn, then you kind of wait for the gap and go, right? And that's the situation on 82nd often because at many of the signals you don't have a protective left turn phase. And that, as you probably realize, then that creates a lot of conflicts. And sometimes those conflicts are with other oncoming cars, and sometimes those conflicts are with people trying to cross at the crosswalk. So these are the types of crash types that we see often on 82nd Avenue and on similar types of corridors. Another is pedestrian crashes of people who are trying to cross, where it's a legal crossing, but there's no enhanced crosswalk. So low visibility. And this is a picture, unfortunately, that I took just one day that we were out there doing a safety review. This kid is riding his bike on the sidewalk because there are no bike lanes. And as you can see, then this is one of the places on 82nd where there is a gap in the sidewalk. And so he is actually bouncing on his bike right now and waiting for oncoming traffic to slow enough that he can try and make the gap and ride contraflow in the car lane until the next place where there's a sidewalk. And so those are the types of things that we want to make sure that we're taking care of with this measure, that we're improving safety by closing those places where there are gaps in the sidewalk right now, by thinking about how bicyclists are going to be getting around as well. A couple other things that I have highlighted here are there are a lot of bus stops on 82nd Avenue, and this 72 bus, I believe, it carries more ridership than any other bus line in the region. And so you have a lot of people walking to the bus stops and trying to cross. And if you're trying to cross the roadway right here to get to the bus stop, then you don't have a place to cross that feels safe. Another piece that I mentioned is that we think a lot about lighting. That's for comfort, but it's also so that people can be seen. And so that people can see their surroundings. And 82nd is a great example of a corridor where you don't have any pedestrian scale lighting. The lighting that's out there really is only on one side of the road. It's only in some places. And so when we're thinking about improving lighting, then that's an important thing for these high dashboards. So I just gave you a little bit of a preview, but some of the safety elements that we are adding in the safety project for 82nd Avenue are adding those enhanced crossings, adding lighting, adding sidewalks or filling those sidewalk gaps, improving signals to add protected left turns where we can, and including pedestrian handholds where we can, managing access points. So some of those old driveways that aren't being used anymore, then closing those out so that people aren't trying to turn into them. A leading pedestrian interval. Thank you. Good question. Leading pedestrian interval is where when the signal changes, then the pedestrian gets a couple extra seconds. And that means that they get closer to the roadway in a location where they can be more easily seen by all of the other traffic around there. And it really kind of, it does improve, safety countermeasure. Thank you. Managing access points, and then providing a parallel neighborhood gateway for bicyclists. So not providing bicycle lanes on the street because of constraints on the street, but this project would fund the parallel neighborhood greenway for cyclists. Because we do try and think about some of these safety countermeasures being very similar to others that you're going to see on other corridors throughout the zoning measure, then some of those that are similar are going to be ones like 122nd, 185th on the west side, 152nd back on the east side, and 181st back on the east side. So thinking about the kind of the context of the corridor. Now, TV Highway and McLaughlin are two that I haven't mentioned yet, or two that are a little bit different than 82nd in terms of their context. So they provide more regional connectivity, but then they also do serve as the downtown main street for some communities along the roadway. There's a large need to serve current and future development along TV Highway, and really, the way that we can think about this is you can see that there have been a lot of houses and businesses that have built up in areas that were before rural. And because of that, then the roadway is still designed to have more of those rural feelings, and it doesn't serve the multimodal users that we need it to when there is that development. There's also a higher likelihood of more severe crashes on some of these faster roadways like TV Highway because of the high risk limit. And there's a higher occurrence of pedestrian crashes, especially near transit stops. And actually, about over 70% of the pedestrian crashes on TV Highway were within 250 feet of transit stops. So when we're thinking about where to add crossings, then these are considerations we're taking into account. So because of that, when we're going to be adding some of those similar elements, so lighting, sidewalk infill, along the highway and along the Boston Boulevard as we would for these other corridors, but we might do it a little bit differently. And so as an example, then you can see that there are three different types of crossings here. So this is kind of a half signal. This is what we call a pedestrian microbeacon. You can get that red signalization here. These are rectangular rapid flashing beacons. And these are all considered enhanced crossings. But you're going to add different types of enhanced crossings depending on the different corridor context. So even though we have a lot of these similar elements on TV and on the block that we will on 82nd, when we're developing the projects, then they're going to look a little bit different. So I'm going to move into transit, and we should have time at the end for questions if you want to jot them down along the way as we go. So transit, why transit? Why is transit an important outcome for this measure? Really, it does help us reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, and that's a big part of the metro region's climate smart strategy. It provides improved mobility for people of all ages and all abilities. And it's a very efficient way to move people, and so it reduces traffic congestion. Because if you think about the amount of space that it takes to move 50 people, 40 to 50 people in cars, they're each driving themselves, that's a lot of space, and that's a lot of traffic congestion. So putting them all on a bus actually can help reduce that traffic congestion. Our transit system also provides that regional connectivity that we're looking for, especially for this measure. A key consideration when we're thinking about developing these transit projects for these corridors is that if we want to be improving transit reliability in kind of the outer counties or in the outer part of the region, then we have to look at where the delay is happening along the route. And sometimes that's in kind of the downtown or central city area. So even if you have somebody trying to get farther out in the county, then their transit delay could be dependent on what's happening closer in. So we try and think about these things holistically. When we're thinking about different types of transit projects, then we can think about them kind of on a spectrum. So over here, then we have more investment. Over here, we have less investment. So I'm going to start over on the left side. And these are not all mutually exclusive. So we can also think about these as kind of a toolbox, picking and choosing from multiple of these in order to create one corridor project. So on the left, we have transit ready. So in some of the areas where there is not a lot of development right now, so there's not that density that would support kind of high-capacity transit or transit at this time, then we can think about developing these projects so that when that development happens, then they're ready, and that space is reserved for transit stops and for things like parking rides. So that's on the very kind of the very far end of the spectrum over here. Moving forward, then we have queue jumps and transit signal priority. And these are different elements that are relatively low investment that can help us to get through some of that congestion or some of that delay at some key signals. So allowing us to either go around the delay or around the congestion with a queue jump, or allowing the bus to actually talk to the signal and give it a couple extra seconds of green to let the bus go through. Next up is going to be business access transit lanes. So you can think about these as kind of bus-only lanes or transit-only lanes that also allow turning vehicles in them. And even this can be put on a spectrum. So you can have these BAT lanes or these business access transit would be adding or improving light rail service, so for the MAX, and then even farther along would be adding the downtown tunnels we'll talk about in a second, but actually removing the MAX from any of your kind of ground level delays that might happen from either cars crashing into it or protests or anything else that's causing delays. I work at
Pioneer Square. I work at Pioneer Square.
But transit isn't just about these types of elements. It's also about your comfort and the quality of experience. And so baked into these projects, baked into these transit projects that you have, are also things like improved feeling of security at the stops, so adding lighting at each of the stops, actually adding bus shelters, adding real-time service information, and ease of getting to and from the stops. These are all considerations as well. So adding those crossings near bus stops is a big one for transit, but also for safety, as we've seen. And here's an example. So for the TV Highway and for 82nd, these are where these projects are going to be a little bit more similar, then we are thinking about kind of a variety. Oops, I think I went, here we go. Kind of a variety of tools. So some of these queue jumps and transit signal priorities, as well as business access transit lanes, potentially all the way up to corridor scale. To help transit move more efficiently. And like I mentioned, then transit signal priority, bat lanes, along the entire corridor or in key locations. Moving farther along, I know that there's been a lot of talk about Southwest Corridor today, but moving farther along would be the Southwest Corridor MAX addition. This addition would allow light rail to carry projected 20% of peak southbound commuters from downtown Portland. And there has already been extensive planning process to try and identify community needs, which is why you heard it was kind of taken out of the LIT process and had its own process. And then finally, kind of moving farther along in our spectrum, then the downtown tunnel study. So this really would be a study to figure out if it's feasible and what it would look like for us to put the MAX underground through downtown. And like I mentioned a couple of reasons for that, but really it would be so that we can provide more reliable MAX on-time performance far into the future and speed up trips that are going to or through downtown. And some of the numbers have been run on that, and it looks like it would improve travel time from the Lloyd District to Goose Hollow, so through downtown by up to 13 minutes, which is very significant. Moving into supporting regional growth. So last year, we saw about 1,000 new residents per month move to the Portland region. Because we do have these land use plans and we already have a set urban boundary, then we do have some corridors that are intended to provide connectivity to areas within this urban growth boundary where that growth is expected. And there is a special focus on areas with heavy freight movement and expected jobs and population growth. Two of these corridors are C to C, or Clackamas to Columbia, and Sunrise to Highway 212. And again, these two corridors really think about to support those regional and local land use plans. accountable and guided communities development in an area where that has been divided in the past by transportation projects. So it's a little bit more significant that we can try and use transportation projects to bring them back together. And these projects within that line of vision include multimodal connectivity and streetscape elements within this area. The Ross Island Bridgehead is also another project, this one's within the Central City Corridor, that also can provide kind of extra space for housing development. So this Ross Island Bridgehead project is taking those on-ramps to the Ross Island Bridge, which were designed back in a time when we used to design on-ramps and things to be really big and really fast. And so it's looking at those and redesigning them kind of with a 2019 mindset, which would actually tighten things up and provide more space down there for development that is currently being used kind of for big transportation infrastructure. The Central City in Motion project is also a really important project to talk about when we're talking about supporting regional growth. So because there are so many important transit projects within this Central City in Motion major project, really these are intended to provide investments downtown that do impact the entire region, so try and speed up that downtown transit so that it can get everywhere else it needs to in the region faster, which allows us to move more people more efficiently. And also includes a lot of key safety improvements. So making sure that we are kind of connecting our regional growth with transit and also with safety, thinking about these things holistically. And then the last regional growth corridor example that I'll share with you is for TV Highway. This is also kind of a different type of regional growth. So looking at this new development that is happening on TV Highway and along that corridor that is supporting those regional and local land use plans. And Hillsborough and surrounding areas are expecting to have more future growth. And this was actually a key, kind of a key point that the LITS brought up this summer, was noting that there is a lot of growth going on out there and that we need to make sure that we're, that we are doing something about it, that we are supporting that growth. And a really important way for us to make sure that that growth kind of helps us meet our climate goals is to make sure that it does have a larger transit element to it. And so that's why the TV Highway, one of the TV Highway projects, is kind of a larger future transit project. Moving along into advancing racial equity. Also a very important outcome for this measure. And some of those key considerations are making sure that we're providing better transit and improved safety in areas where there are higher concentrations of communities of color. Our past pattern of lower investment in these areas means that we need to be very intentional about providing investment in them. And people of color are disproportionately likely to be killed in crashes in our region. So that, you know, that shows that we have even more of a reason to make sure that we're focusing on. I want to show the equity focus area map. And this is communities of color, English language learners in lower income communities overlaid with the tier one and the tier two corridors. And just point out a couple of these corridors. So starting over on the west side, then 185th and TV Highway, you can see that those overlays are quite significant. Over on the east side, we also have quite a few significant corridors. I've already mentioned that the Albina Vision is kind of one of those key areas, but we also have a lot of these key areas on the outer east side, like 82nd Avenue, 122nd, 162nd, and 181st. And you're
probably starting to see some of these, I mean, a lot of key themes coming up. These are also high cash corridors, and so kind of another reason for us to make sure that we're focusing on them, but also because people of color are disproportionately likely to be killed in crashes. So again, thinking about these holistically, making sure that we are focusing our investments in the crash. So our strategy in doing this is to invest to improve transit and safety in areas where people of color live, work, and travel, and to provide those better access to opportunities, often through transit, for people of color. Moving into addressing climate change, then we know that transportation is the largest contributor to greenhouse gases in the United States, and we now know that that is true for Oregon specifically as well, and that reducing emissions is a key goal for the Metro Council and Task Force. And Metro's Climate Smart Strategy is one of the top regional strategies in the nation focused on transportation. So a lot of other regional strategies kind of miss the ball on transportation, and the Metro region is not. It's one of the key ones that actually focuses on transportation. So that makes it all the more important for this measure. To do this, then we need to reduce the number of cars on the road and reduce our climate emissions that way by providing safe, reliable transit, like we discussed, and places for people biking and walking. Again, kind of getting back to that theme of thinking about these things holistically, then when we provide more options for transit, then we can allow for more people to live without cars. But all of these modes kind of help support each other. So people biking and walking to transit, or people who bike and walk predominantly and take transit for those longer trips, or people who take transit more often, but then also support that with biking and walking. Which is why for these corridors, then all three of these kind of multimodal options are priorities within the project selection. All right, that was a lot of information. So if anybody has any questions, we're happy to answer them.
So thank you very much for the presentation. That was a lot of information to take in. Just on the racial equity, I mean, one of the things that I'm concerned about using that as a measurement is how are we planning for future growth for communities of color? You know, because if you look at what this region looked like 20 years ago in East Portland, for instance, it was a very different demographic, where we know now there are many, many different kinds of communities living in East Portland, and even, you know, further out in East County and in other areas. And so how is that factored in terms of the corridors that were highlighted?
Hi there, I'm the Deputy Director of the Planning Department, Marty Bradley. We did a couple things in the RPP process. We're continuing to look at this, and we call it community stabilization. The first thing that we're doing internally is we're starting to track census data where people are moving by race, and we've got now overlay maps where we can start better tracking that to see the trends. In terms of what we did, this is again just geographical, but for the RCQ, we did an in-depth analysis of not only where people live, but how they access their jobs and how they access to schools. And that report is online. It's the Regional Transportation Plan. It's the equity analysis. It's pretty thick, but it gets you closer not only to where people are living, but where their jobs are. So I agree, we have a lot more work to do. I think when the package of projects comes together, we can start to overlay some of these trends.
Sheila? You can talk into your mic.
It was great to have TriMet here tonight and recently, and we've been talking a lot from the beginning about how we really have to leverage a lot of resources to get to make progress on so many ambitious goals. And so just thinking about the ideas that you shared tonight and how we do affect climate change, increase ridership, advance racial equity, I mean, all those seem to have so much to do with what we develop along transit corridors. And I think we've seen really amazing data from Metro, what happens when you do make a priority for what happens along transit-oriented development areas. So changing the policies to be more affirmatively favoring those who ride transit a lot for Metro made a big difference in how many affordable housing projects got funded, and I'm sure had an impact on ridership in those areas. So, you know, we did have a chance to ask TriMet a little bit about that, and I know that's something that's being considered again, their disposition policies. It seems like this is just a missed opportunity if we don't really emphasize now what that additional leverage could do. If those policies are more affirmative on TriMet's side, it's not the housing bond, but it is the transportation sector. So I think, you know, just want to make that point that between housing and transportation, we sometimes get siloed, and so we really have talked about intentionally, can we leverage these sources? Maybe the timing isn't quite right. But TriMet's policies will be in place forever, not just on these investments that we're looking at, but for the future. So I hope there's just a continuing opportunity to talk about that here, because it feels like an unresolved issue that's moving forward on a separate track, perhaps, at TriMet.
So I'll just leave it there for you, waiting for your answer.
Thank you. Just, I don't expect an answer tonight, but one other thing staff and I have talked about is that as we move forward to develop this list of corridors we want to present, I really think we have to figure out some practical piece of how does this play with the public? How many people are going to be touched? How many people are going to benefit from it? I think that's really important. That's the practical part of what some decision makers have to do. And also, I want to make sure that this, whatever region we pick to take to the ballot box, supports the entire region, not just one particular area. I think we need to balance that. I'm not saying we haven't, but to me, that's really an important part. You just look at the affordable housing bond measure, what we did, how we decided how we were going to, you know, take the funds and put them out. And so I'm just looking at a practical comment, and hopefully that gets passed on to our great Metro Council for decision making.
We'll go to Tim, and then Dave, and then Stephen. But just a reminder, folks, I think folks in the back are having a hard time hearing us this evening, so if we can speak into the mics, that'd be great. And project.
Thank you. I just want to emphasize a couple of points. Mr. Bottomley up there was a question about Modeshare for transit. I work extensively, as many of us here and other people did, on Climate Smart. We have got to get off of thinking about single-digit percentages of our trips being on transit to achieve any significant change. You know, we've had numbers that say 4%, 7%. You know, we've got to be talking about 25 or 30 or 35% in order to make anything happen. And that means a very significant ongoing investment in transit that we have not put in place yet since climate change, you know, was really put on the table. So that's just really critical. We've got to think about our systems as a whole, not just this piece or that corridor or this one over here. The whole thing has to connect. You have to be able to get on a bus and go where you need to go, or get on light rail and go where you need to go, or it will not draw the usage that it needs to draw. If you live on Gresham side of things and you need to get to Hillsboro, is that even possible? Well, if you got half a day, I mean, that's not a practical answer. You've got to be able to make that trip. If you live on the south side and you are have an opportunity to work downtown, you have to be able to do that and know that you can get there and get home. Otherwise, people are just going to continue to be in their cars on an ongoing basis. So all of that leads me to thinking about, you know, what is the magnitude of what we're doing here or what we're proposing to do? And it seems to me like we're in danger of being too timid, of ratcheting down our expectations, of saying, well, this is all we can really think about doing, you know, so let's dial it back. We have to go the other direction. We're going to have to push beyond the comfort level in order to achieve the kinds of transformative change and support for our communities throughout the region that we really are talking about. So we've just got to figure out how to commit to something bigger than just doing, you know, the low end of what we can see right now. So, thank you.
Dave, I'll pass it over to you.
Yeah, question, just maybe this is a combo answer from Maggie and Camilla, and thanks for your presentation. That was really good. On the racial equity slides, you have this the slide that talks about low investments in areas of concentrations of people of color, and the one on disproportionately likely to be killed in crashes around the region. And so I guess my hypothesis there is, it's because it doesn't exactly connect the dots, and I'm maybe looking for that dot connecting, is that a lot of those crashes are in those areas where the lack of investment has happened, not just sort of broadly throughout the region. And I'm wondering, when you think of these corridors where that those areas overlap and the type of projects that can move the needle, are we talking, I mean, all of the above, okay, but what, when it really in those areas do we need to get prioritize transit versus PED versus, you know, the kind of safe street? I mean, where do we really want to sort of stack the order of what needs to get done in those areas to reduce these deaths?
So I'll take this one. Can anybody hear me? Oh, here we go. So let's just go back to your first question. What is the relationship, the factors that make it disproportionately people of color disproportionately impacted by traffic crashes? First, fatals usually happen with speed, and it doesn't matter if anybody, if there's drunk or not drunk, if you're at a high speed going 20 miles an hour, you have a pedestrian has 90% chance of living. Hit at 40 miles an hour, you only have a 10% chance of living. So think of speed. Speed often happens beyond arterials, usually not neighborhood collectors or higher. So arterials are where we have speed. Arterials are also where we have density of low-income housing. High-income housing doesn't tend to be on our arterials. So you combine where there's availability of low-income housing, you combine the availability of low-income services, and then you combine the speed and volume of the vehicle traffic, and there's where your fatals come from. To your second question, these are huge corridors that we're looking at. Before this position, I used to be the safety division manager at PBOT and worked on the division project as well as others of these large arterials where there are trade-offs. Anytime you have a high volume of cars, you're looking at, constrained right-of-way, usually a high volume of cars where you're trying to do a lot of things, a multimodal. And, we look for opportunities where you can make improvements, slow traffic down but not get it to a halt, which is good for safety, but then give buses kind of priority. So a good example, frankly, is when you have some kind of a bat lane or a lane, when you take a lane for transit, you actually reduce the pedestrian crossing. So without that transit lane, we a lot of times we'd look at where we could put a median in the island. It's good. The technical engineering term for it is a pedestrian refuge. But if you have a bat lane in place, sometimes that can reduce the crossing and create that refuge. So those are the things that you look for, win-wins with transit and pedestrian crossings. But it's really complex. I'm not trying to simplify it. Yeah.
I'm going to go over to Michael, and then over to you, Stephen.
Okay. I wanted to sort of offer maybe a bit of a clarification. When we talk about the area of the Rose Quarter and the Arbonne Division, it's sort of clustered with a number of downtown projects. And in some ways, I don't want to have it defined that way. It is a focus on a unique area that has been burdened by transportation initiatives, not benefited from them. And so they're not starting in the same place as a number of the other communities that we're looking at that are looking to enhance or expand. We're starting from scratch in many ways here. And so I would hope that we don't sort of get lost in a broader definition. And there are legitimate alignment around 2025 or 2035. I mean, I understand that, but I don't want us to necessarily be constrained in that way. It is a microcosm that has many of the design elements and the projects embedded in some work that PBOT has done with us that I think is good work, but it literally has to be targeted at construction of a deconstructed community. And in some ways, if we sort of lump ourselves too closely with things that dilute that, I think we lose the ability to sort of have something very remarkable happen here. You know, again, I'm heartened by the fact that the discussion around Albina has moved away from I-5. You know, I think it was larger than that, bigger than that, and separate from that. But at the same time, there were impacts of that that would have done harm had we have not sort of taken a position on it. So I just would offer that caution.
Thank you. The last slide was, you know, around addressing climate change and the climate smart strategy, and talked about reducing cars on the road, which I think is the goal. You know, one of the more significant goals in the whole project, because not only does it address greenhouse gas reduction, I imagine it also has safety implications and actually probably has equity implications, because the more people can rely on transit and not have to own a car or reduce the amount of investment that they have in cars. So it's a win-win-win. What I'm wondering is how we're going to, you know, in the package, track and model the reduction of cars on the road when our transit agency apparently doesn't track ridership in their service plan, which I would imagine as a layperson would be one way to know that a person's on a bus or they're in a car. And certainly, you know, we're hoping that the investments will get more people on bikes. And today's Willamette Week's, yesterday's, today's, whatever. The current one has, you know, electric bikes. And actually, that's going to make a big difference for sure. And I think we need to start talking more about that in our planning. But I want to come back to, you know, the main question is, how are you going to model greenhouse gas reductions around reducing cars on the road without that kind of information from TriMet?
So we do get ridership numbers from TriMet. Some of those are actual numbers. Some of those are modeled numbers based on what we know, and we build those into our model. We also have ways, you know, our travel demand model is fed into, I don't want to go too technical on you, but it's like a moves or a mobile model that we use. We do this on an annual basis. We model our greenhouse gases and track them as part of our commitment and climate start strategy. And on a regular basis, we report to DLCD on our progress towards climate smart. So we will be doing that. We do that as part of our MPO and as part of our commitment to climate smart, regardless of this measure or not. And I'm happy to walk you through that.
I mean, I understand.
But it's overall. Oh, for the measure or for the region?
I think that, you know, you're referring to this. I mean, we have all the ridership data through, you know, last year.
Right.
And, you know, I think I'm trying to build on what Mayor Knapp was saying. I mean, did I misunderstand Mr. Bottomley? I mean, they do have service projections in their plan.
Right.
Ridership projections in their plan.
I see. Because, gotcha. So you're talking correct. Service line by service line. Right.
What I heard, what I thought I heard him say was service hours.
So I think what they're trying to say is they're not modeling when you add a service hour, how many riders does that add? They're modeling what do we think the system will provide in terms of ridership. We do a similar thing with our climate analysis. We don't model project by project what does this do for our climate goals. We look at the system performance.
Sure.
So as we add projects into that and assume those investments, that gives us a better picture of what the how we're reaching our climate goals. I would also just remind folks there are four planks to the climate strategy for the region. One is investing in transit and bike and ped to provide folks another option. The second is advancing the suite of fuels so there are fewer fossil fuel burning vehicles, and that's a piece of the better or the electric bus concept, but there's a much broader policy question there about individual vehicles. Another is pricing the system. So we are sending signals about use of the transportation system. And the last is, as Mr. Bottomley referred to, reaching our goals for how we develop in this region. So we have people are able to be closer into centers, their home can be closer to jobs, more accessible to transit. So four major planks. We're sort of focusing in on a couple that we can in the measure. We can't really affect federal policy around fuels. We can affect how the region grows by some of these investments, though.
There, okay. Yeah, TriMet provides the board with ridership on a quarterly basis, and so we have current, we know what current ridership is, and actually our ridership is starting to increase. And most people think that it's continuing to drop, but it's not. It's actually increasing. And so I'd be glad to provide you with current ridership information on the system.
It wasn't my question. My question was in the five-year service plan.
You mean in terms of estimating or forecasting?
Yeah, I mean, I've been around estimates how much business they're going to do. And I imagine in the transit business, it's like how many people are getting on the buses or how many are getting on the because, the fundamental question around that, and again, to build on what Mayor Knapp was saying, is the number of people getting on our transit system will tell us whether you have a transformative investment or not. Because if it's 2% a year, that's barely staying ahead of regional growth in terms of population.
One of the key numbers that Mr. Bottomley gave us was that with the Southwest Corridor, there's estimated a 40 million riders on the Southwest Corridor in terms of they've been able to look at the population, where the population is going, and to be able to forecast that. They can't tell you exactly what it's going to actually result in, but it can talk about what the capacity would be to serve.
The last thing I'll say is no business knows exactly what's going to happen in the future.
No.
But most businesses model what they think they're going to do so they can plan. And I'm just raising this, so I'm trying to understand the interaction between TriMet, Metro, from a planning standpoint, and what this task force is going to recommend to council, within a month.
You know, the last thing I'd like to say, and it's in response to Tim's comment about maybe we're not thinking big enough, I feel like what we're seeing in our communities is a deferred maintenance or a lack of basic service consistent throughout the region, and it's like we're trying to rectify that. And we have to rectify that and go bold, but to go bold without rectifying it doesn't make any sense. And, that's just from a very practical standpoint. I'm also aware that the public expects results within a certain time frame. And if we put out to them something that isn't attainable I look at how long it takes these big projects to be realized, and, people start to believe that you don't mean what you say because you haven't delivered on it when the Southwest Corridor has been talked about since 2011 or maybe before then, and the division project has gone on for years and years and years and years. And one of the frustrations for me on the board is, oh, my gosh, these things take so long. But they take a long time because you have to involve lots of people and make sure that you are applying the proper solution to whatever the issue is. And so I believe I feel we should be looking at this as a two-stage process. One stage, which is to put a bond out there that addresses and rectifies all of these deficiencies that we have across our region, and realize that as we prepare for maybe something more monumental in the future.
So I want to second what Mayor Knapp said, that, and this is what we had called for 3 years ago. It is on. I'll swallow the mic. It is what we called for, 3-4 years ago as we were doing several other processes, was to go big or we will not fail. We will not inspire people to vote for a bond measure if it doesn't really look like significant change, and certainly if it's not going to cause significant change. But on a more specific point, two different pieces that we've learned tonight. One, that most of the pedestrian accidents that occurred, I think it was on TV Highway, occurred within 250 feet of a transit stop, and that you're more likely to be killed on high-speed roads as a pedestrian than you are on not high-speed roads. So it begs the question, then, why are we putting our transit on collectors or arterials? Why aren't we putting our transit, much like we do bicycle greenways, on their own street, therefore removing that interaction, a block off of the arterials, which then will make the bus system safer and pedestrians, it could also make the buses move faster.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. When we're thinking about planning and designing for each of the different modes, then there we do have all of these different considerations. And when we're thinking about designing for bicycles, then we have to think about it very differently than designing for transit, because transit does need to move at higher speeds in order to provide kind of that expected, really that regional reach that it needs to be able to provide. And when we're designing roadways, then we design our arterials and collectors so that they can provide more of that kind of regional reach. Whereas when we're thinking about providing facilities for bicyclists, for example, then we want to make sure that those are on much more comfortable for biking type of a location, which sometimes is providing that regional reach on our arterials or on our collectors and providing the necessary protection that is needed when you're next to high-speed traffic. But if we were to put our buses on kind of those smaller neighborhood greenways, then you wouldn't be able to get as efficient transit service. And then if you do need them to go as fast, and you are putting them on those neighborhood greenways, then you would actually be kind of introducing faster speeds onto the.
So I'm not necessarily talking about mixing them with the bikes. What I'm saying is that they would have their own separate facility that they could then go at whatever speeds we deem that they go at, and we limit the car access to those streets, thereby reducing congestion, reducing the number of cars that are interacting with the pedestrians that are trying to get to the buses. It's just essentially creating a separate system that is near enough to the arterials that it still serves the population well, but actually allows the buses to be able to move faster, to not be caught in the congestion of the arterials and have the safety problems as well.
Yep, absolutely understand. And I think that Southwest Corridor or providing kind of light rail and those other facilities that are off of our main current arterials today, kind of taking those off, then I think that that probably gets to your point of wanting to provide that separated transit service that's specific, more specific to transit.
I guess my question, I'm going to go back to the Sheila's question, which is, I think, I don't know if I get to be addressed. I guess anytime we do development and strategy, if we don't think about it in terms of...
It's on,
actually. Okay. Folks can hear me? All right, I think I'm just going to go back to Sheila's question. I don't know if I was adequately addressed. When we're talking about development, anytime we talk about development and it comes to community, what we realize, what we saw in the past is that there is a displacement can happen. And I'm wondering if there is this project you mentioned, if there is a way to, you have thought about mitigating displacement in terms of the affordable housing, and if we were laid that as we move forward. I guess that's my question, and I don't know if I had to be at, I don't know if you can address.
So that was a question about displacement on corridors and any strategies to mitigate the effects of displacement that might happen.
Yeah. I think
I'll take a whack at this one. So there's a couple, two different ways to look at this. You can have a housing strategy and you can have a transportation strategy, and hopefully those two strategies are coordinated and pointing at each other, right? So if you're involved in Metro's affordable housing measure, as many of you know, we passed a big housing measure. One of those is kind of a land acquisition program, and the goal there that has many criteria and goal, but one of those is to purchase property for affordable housing near key transit corridors. And that housing team sits right next to the transit team. They're all part of the same team, so we're talking to each other every day. And they're actually excited that we're looking closely at TV Highway, so we're not as separate. But the other piece of it, and I think this came up in the programs discussion, is we are proposing some programs to be part of this measure to help with strategies on displacement that would provide either programming or a percentage to better coordinate that affordable housing with transportation. So hopefully we've got kind of two different programs and two different measures to point to each other. The third thing, and I think is this, was there a reference to a Todd policy? Was that coming up? I'm not sure if that's pointed at TriMet or Metro, but either way, we talk, we coordinate all the time. I think their goals and our goals are similar. Like you said, there is a return on investment for them. And I know their GM, Doug, is very committed to, in fact, I think they're hiring a Todd manager to really focus on this. They've been very focused on it with Doug's leadership on Todd policy. And we've had meetings to make sure that whatever we're doing in the Todd space is coordinated with TriMet, and we're employing the same strategies. So I'm not sure if I answered that question, but I'm getting a lot of head nodding from TriMet staff. That would be my three answers
to
that.
Does everybody know what Todd is?
What?
Transit-oriented development.
Todd is transit-oriented development, and there's a lot of discussion about how we take what was a traditional development model and turn that into an affordable housing transit-oriented development model. Thank you. Sorry for the acronym.
Brief comment. With regard to Mayor Gamba and to the response that he got to the off-arterial transit discussion, think about that heavily used corridor in Denver that runs through a couple of miles through the commercial area and does not allow any cars on the street there. It's buses going back and forth. There are other places around the country where that's been done. No, you can't run your whole system off arterial, but there are very significant places in commercial centers where it has proven to be extremely effective, and we should not dismiss it out of hand, in my view. Second point is with regard to the TriMet strategy. I don't disagree that we have to get things on the ground and show people we can do it, but if we're going to get people to vote for this, I think, and I've talked to many people that think, people have to understand that this is an initial step in a broader strategy. And unless people understand that broader strategy and where it's going, they're going to be disinclined if they don't see a project in their local area that says, well, you know, they're getting something over there, but it's nothing for me, so why should I vote for it? I mean, they've got to understand the overall vision of the thing, the overall intent, and where we're committing to going with this in order to buy into it. Again, from my perspective, and I've talked to other people that feel very similarly. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone for this robust conversation. I think that this is exactly what we're here for, and I'm looking forward to seeing everybody again in 2 weeks. So we will be back here on October 30th, same time, same place, and we'll be having further discussion on this topic. You're also going to be receiving an online survey that the Metro staff will be sending out, and I really encourage you to fill that out as well. So in an effort to always be on time with our meetings, we thank you for your evening here and travel safely. Yeah. I would have done it.
Nice to
but
thank you. Gotta keep pushing, don't we?
I get it.
Good job.
That was good. Interesting if you have any questions.
Yeah, wait, questions, please.